Give a warm welcome to Lynn.
Thank you. My name is Lynn. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Lynn.
And I want to thank the group here for giving us these cute little Miss Kitty. Miss Kitty. Very thoughtful. Thank you, Tom, for inviting us. And I appreciate that you allowed me to have Nancy come and do her pitch, because I think the most thrilling part for me is to have sponsees do their pitches, because I remember me doing my very first one, and it was scary as can be. And so to be able to split it with somebody is great, because it's a long time for 45 minutes. And actually, she was doing so well, I was hoping she'd go longer. As a few of you are, I'm kind of the products of the 60s and 70s. And my parents moved out here in the 50s when I was 6 months old. And I had older brothers and sisters, three older brothers from my father's first marriage and an older sister from my mom's first marriage. But they were all back in Michigan. So I basically am considered an only child. Growing up here in California, I really don't remember a whole heck of a lot until I got to probably fifth or sixth grade. What I do remember is my half-brothers and sisters coming and visiting periodically. My parents seemed to argue a lot, and it was just the time of the year, I mean, not the time of the year, it's time in life during those 60s that, as Nancy shared, our parents came from the wartime. So my parents got married, or my mom and my father got their first marriage was during wartime and that. And so that whole product of that type of generation, then all of a sudden in the late 50s, early 60s, life really became good. You know, your 40s, 50s, 60s, life was really good. A lot of drinking, a lot of partying. I remember my parents going to the neighbors and having card parties. I mean, Christmas was something you walk the kids around and they had a glass in their hand. They got it filled. Maybe that was Halloween. Got it filled, you know, and the kids got their candy. And just, it was really a whole different world then. And drinking and smoking and all that lifestyle was just the way it was. And growing up and looking at older siblings, even my cousins were older. I was just like the little one. Nobody wanted Lynn around because she was way too little. But I would watch them, and, you know, my real remembrance is turning around 12 years of age, because we'd moved to this new town. And my cousins, a male and a female, moved to California from Michigan, and my male cousin went into Vietnam, and my female cousin was over at the park at the Love-In smoking pot, taking downers, and just like having life. And I saw this dual life that was going on, and the hecticness, and how one side was just like, you know, we're really into this, and we want war, and we want to make it safer for the United States, and the other side saying, peace, love, no war, you know, it's all this. And, you know, and I wasn't old enough. I'm 12. My parents won't let me go to these love-ins, but one thing that did end up happening is I did get a lot of education from my cousin, because she would get arrested, and my parents would take me down to the jail, and when she got out, she was all on reds and like this, and I thought, ooh, if that drug does that to you and you go and you get arrested on it, I'm not taking that. So I learned downers are no good. Don't take anything that you can't be in control. So that was going to be the beginning of my life. I want to be in control. So alcohol, being it was always around our house, we were the type of family that beer was a daily thing. That wasn't drinking. Beer, you open up 5 o'clock somewhere, you know, I could be 12, 1, 4, you know, there was no timing. But the parties were the hard stuff. So that's how I kind of grew up. I would open my dad's beer, because it was always a refrigerator out in the garage, open my dad's beer, because they always asked me to get it for him, take a sip, and then bring it out to him. And that's just kind of how I did it. It was no big deal. It's a sip. It tastes terrible, but, you know, they get something out of this, so I'm going to try it. And, you know, so that's basically what it was. And we just had this atmosphere. Okay, so now we're going into the 70s, and now we've got Marvin Gaye and all these, you know, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. And, you know, so my sister would come out from Michigan. She separated from her husband, and I'd be babysitting her kids, and she'd have some man in the other room. And I'm thinking, but you're married, you know. And so I'm in my early teens, and this is 13 maybe, 13, 14, and I'm getting these mixed messages again. And that other female cousin that used to go to jail from the Lovins and that, all of a sudden she gets a job out in Nevada, and she's coming home driving these brand new VW, and, you know, she just dressed well and all that, and her mom's bragging about this job she's got in Nevada. It's called the Mustang Ranch. So I've got this view that, wow, you can make money, you know, doing these other things with your body. And so these are just all these mixed messages. Then my parents start having problems, and my mom's doing things. My dad's getting caught jumping over the fence. And, you know, it's like I'm the youngest, and I'm watching all this. So all I know is that if this is what marriage is all about, if this is what life's all about, I want nothing to do with it. Somewhere around 14, 15, 16, I made that decision. I want nothing to do with marriage. I see no purpose in it. The only purpose in marriage is to have kids. If you're gonna have kids, then you really should get married. That's just my view. So that just kind of set me off for my view of life from there on. And, you know, about 17, 18, must have been closer to 18. Yeah, because we graduated from high school, and my girlfriend got her job at a bank, and she was the one that made the fake IDs. So I got it, or the fake IDs, made the IDs to get into the bank. But she made fake IDs for us. So we're like 20, 19, 20, and we're drinking at the bars downstairs at lunch. So I'm already starting that behavior before I'm even 21 to drink at lunch. I'm not liking that you have to go back to work after you drink at lunch. So my girlfriend tells me about another type of job is working in the grocery stores. And, you know, you're your own boss, and you can work your own hours. Now, okay, good, I'm in control. This sounds really like something I'd like to do. And that worked out well, because if I went drinking for lunch, because I usually started my job somewhere 6 in the morning, sometimes 4 in the morning, and if I go drinking for lunch, I don't have to go back to work. Because I'll just tell the meat manager, to tell the store manager that I'll finish my job tomorrow. And, you know, they enabled me so well. It was a perfect job for me, because then I could go get a second job in the afternoon, which was a bar job. And in those days, they let you drink while you work. So what a perfect deal. You go get a job that you can drink at for free. And unfortunately, though, then you have to get home in time to get up at 2 in the morning to be to work at 4 in the morning with the hangover, so that you go in the cooler and hang out in the cooler to help the headache, to get back out on the floor and physically work. And then, you know, you do about 4 hours of hard physical work, and now you're feeling a little bit better. Well, hell, it's about 10 in the morning, getting close. So, you know, the whole pattern. And that's what happened to me, is I just got in this pattern of work hard so that I could be at the job that I really want to be, so I could do the thing that I really want to do, to go back and work hard, make the good money so that I could do what I really want to do. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm in my middle, late 20s, and I'm doing the same thing over and over again. And, you know, I'm watching friends of mine that have now gotten married, had kids. Some of them have gotten divorced. But, I mean, they're actually having a life, and I'm still doing the same thing I started doing at 19. And one of the interesting things is that I used to go to this cop bar. It was my boyfriend's brother worked there. And all the cops hung out. And I can remember one night very clearly, one of the cops sitting there talking to me and saying, if should you ever get pulled over, what you want to do is a urine test. Because I don't know why he said, but this is what you want to do, right? And I'm thinking, wow, he's giving me such wonderful information. Wonder why he's giving it to me. Obvious. Okay, well, that's in L.A. Then all of a sudden I moved to Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara is really the pits, because they have highway patrol, sheriffs, you know, the local cops. They have so many in such a tiny little town. How could nobody not get a DUI? You know, I had been there 3 months, got my drunk driving, which I never got in the L.A. area. And I was real smart. I knew how to do this. This cop told me. Well, that was pretty stupid because now they've already got me in jail. I'm done the urine test, and I'm obviously can't get out of that. And I'm being very, let's see, their wording was she's cooperative but evasive. I didn't even know what that meant. When I got my lawyer, I said, what does evasive mean? Well, what it was, I was standing there at the desk, whatever it is. I'm sure there was glass there. And I said, well, this is interesting. This is what it looks like from the other side, or some from this side of the cop bar, or something like that. And he goes, oh, are you a cop? I said, no, but I know some down in Arcadia. And he goes, oh, Arcadia cops are pussies. And I said, well, they would probably say the same thing of you. Just being funny, you know. But they were nice to me, and I did get let out the next day, as you usually do. So, you know, that was my experience. Oh, and in that time, they also had a ruling that if you get a drunk driving, you had to spend 48 hours in jail. So I spent my first 9 that night, and then I think a month later went back sober for the weekend to hang out at the jail to see what it was like. And I think that was a really good rule because it gave me a chance to go sit in the dungeon with the girls, look around and say, I need her protecting me and I need this one to stay away from me. You know, and it was just enough to give that day and a half to realize, is this what I want to do for the rest of my life? Is this where I want to go in and out of? And of course I made the decision no, but did I quit drinking? Definitely not. You know, that wasn't going to deter me. And I went probably another 3 or 4 years, went to my meetings, did all the things I was supposed to do, and finally came to the rooms, got a sponsor, little old lady in a wheelchair, 25 years sobriety. She was not my first sponsor, but she was the one that I actually did the steps with. She was the one that was so non-judgmental, so easy to be with. Plus, I'm the type of person, don't want to go to the meetings, you know, can't go there by myself. So I had this little old lady to be able to push her wheelchair into the meeting. That made me feel like I could be invisible. She's the one that gets the attention. You know, whatever it takes to get in here. You know, I've heard guys say, yeah, there's cute women there. Great. Come for the cute women. You won't get a hold of them, but come on in for the cute women. You know, it doesn't matter how we get here, what attracts us. Just keep coming back. You know, because that's what, I mean, my whole life changed. I had the chance to keep following those two cousins. The one that came back from Vietnam was very similar to what Nancy had shared about her father and her son, just that whole scenario. And so he's still alive. The female cousin, she's not alive. She just died last year of our disease, definitely. But he's had a rough path. I mean, both of those cousins ended up out there in 29 Palms, which I'm not saying that 29 Palms is bad, but it's that white trash trailer park life that I was heading. Because that's exactly where I was going to go. I was following them. They were the people I wanted to follow. I didn't have any brothers or sisters out here. I didn't have anybody to follow. And I really just wanted to be part of. And because of my sister getting in a car accident, God intervened and took me to Santa Barbara instead. And with that drunk driving, that introduced me to AA. And I went to meetings. And it was enough to be able to say, these people are laughing. These people look good. These people talk about the things I'm doing right now. They talk about the behavior that I did. Blackouts. I didn't know there was a name for it. I mean, I kind of did, but when you really described them, and I remembered that one time driving on the LA freeways, took me 3 freeways to get from Linwood to Arcadia. I don't even remember leaving the bar, let alone getting in the car and driving home. You know, and that was a scary moment for me, but never enough to quit drinking. You just got to do a little more controlling, that's all. And I don't know, it's been really, really good. You know, I'm lucky to be able to sponsor girls. I'm lucky to have the best sponsors. When I moved here, I didn't have a sponsor for the first 6 years. I went to 2 meetings a week. It was the Sunday meeting and the Los Alamos meetings. That's it. For like about 6 years. And then I met this one young girl, and she said, and she'd been around here for a while, and she said, and you don't have a sponsor? Not at the moment. She goes, well, I have one for you. And she took me over and introduced me to Peggy. And Peggy and I mean, we just clicked. We became buddies. We just had the best of time. My grand sponsor was Marilyn, and you know, it's just been a pleasure to be able to have grand sponsors and all that. I really suggest it because you become a family. And when Peggy moved out of town, I was able to have a sponsor that knows me, you know, knows of me. I get a chance to get to have her know me better. The sponsees, again, you know, they talk about, I wish I was a big book thumper. I'm not. But we were just talking about the family after. We just got finished reading that in our women's study group. And, you know, it talks about what we gain when we get to do our fourth and fifth step and get to release and become part of AA by doing that. And then what you gain by sponsoring people and allowing them to do their fourth and fifth step with you, and how we become so much closer. And we become not only become here as a group more, but also part of society. You know, it talks about becoming a worker among workers. All of a sudden, when I got sober, I was really going to be more part of my job, not just go to my job. You know, I just took pride a lot more in that. I worked for Vons for 31 years. Believe me, it wasn't planned on it. I went into there, I left the bank, and I went to the grocery store, and I said, well, this is kind of a cool job. I'll do this till I decide what I want to be. Well, never decided what I wanted to be. 31 years later, I was smart enough to stick it out, go one day at a time, and I got a retirement. A couple years later, after being retired, I realized I needed to do something else, not just for my sanity, but maybe some extra income, and now I'm driving a school bus. And the ironic thing is when I first got sober, there was a girl that was driving a school bus down in Santa Barbara, and I remember looking at her thinking, what an odd job. And a girl doing it? And in those days, you didn't see many girls. But it's just so, what a trip that I remember. I can picture her exactly where she was at, exactly the streets and everything. And now I'm doing the same thing. And I love it. I love it. It's a perfect part-time job. In my life today, I do that. I have my mom, who, when we talk about family, I've been the blessed one. Where my father passed away in 1978. I was 22 years of age, and we were just getting to know each other. His three sons in Michigan really know their dad. I didn't really get to know my dad that well, and hopefully there's two of the three left still, and hopefully someday I'll go to Michigan and actually talk with them and maybe become a family. But even though my father passed away when I was real young, my mom still lives, and about 8, 9 years ago, her and her husband sold their house, and my husband and I sold our house, and we bought a house together. And that way nobody had to feel they were moving into the other person's house and, you know, not feel like it's yours. And 2 years later, my mom's husband passed. But we've been there like 8 years now. My mom just turned 91. It's amazing. You know, she's got her faculties up here. She may ask me the same question 3 times in one day, but I mean, that's mild, you know. Like I was sharing with somebody else earlier today, she's one of these happy-go-luckies. We always called her the lady with rose-colored glasses. And it used to make, you know, my sister and I would be like, oh, God, how can you be so positive about everything? But, you know, thank God she is, because she's a blessing to have in my life. She's a blessing to be able to live with. You know, a lot of people turn grumpy and bitter, and my mom's never been that. You know, she's loved by everybody in her church. The ladies that her outings are going to church on Sunday and getting her hair done every week on Saturday. I would never take that away from her because she loves that. And if I can even be half of what she is, I'll have a chance by staying sober. You know, I know for a fact if I pick up a drink, I'm a bar girl. I'll be back in the bars. That's where I like to hang out. I'm not a home drinker. I'll drink at home. But as soon as you get enough of me, it's like, I know there's something out there that I want to be at, you know. And I get to that bar, and it's boring. There's another bar somewhere over there that's better than this. And that's how I am. I'm a bar hopper, and I drink till I'm done, or I'm arrested, or whatever it is. And I'm grateful to be here, and thank you for allowing both of us to share.
Turn back over. You know what? I can't. Well, Mark.